Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. This week, I'm featuring a wonderful episode from the archive with Lindsay Pollock. This was originally recorded and released in season two of this podcast, 2022. I try to constantly improve every aspect of this podcast since I take care of all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. I really do need the help of my listeners to keep this project going. Please consider buying me a coffee through my support page, which is linked to PayPal. And now to Lindsay Pollock. Lindsay Pollock is an Australian musician who is known worldwide as a passionate and creative advocate for community music. His life has been full of unusual opportunities to explore different styles of music, and his inventiveness has spurred him to create countless instruments from found objects. In this episode, you'll get to hear him play four different instruments in different improvisatory styles, and I'm sure that everyone will be inspired by stories from his life, describing some of his incredibly unusual, fun, and beautiful collaborations and creations. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The video link is in the description, along with detailed timestamps. Good day, Lindsay Pollock.
Good day.
Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
So you are holding a Macedonian gaita?
That's correct. Yeah, there it is. It's actually made in Australia with Australian timber and an Australian goat skin, but I've modelled it on a particular Macedonian bagpipe that I had access to many, many, many decades ago.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So how is that bagpipe different than like a Scottish bagpipe? And maybe there's different types. I don't know about bagpipes.
There are many different bagpipes. There are, well, definitely over 235 different types of bagpipes.
Wow, so okay.
There's one particular book about bagpipes that sort of lists or quotes 235 different types. Since that book was printed, there have been a few different ones invented, including by myself. How it differs from the Scottish pipes. So we have one chanter. The difference with this chanter, apart from the look of it, is that it's got a single reed. So it's a very primitive single reed, mm-hmm. So in a clarinet-type instrument rather than the double reed of the Scottish pipes. It has one drone rather than three drones. But apart from that, it's the same sort of animal. It's using a complete goat skin in this case. They sometimes use sheep, but more often goat skins. And yeah, so that's the main difference.
So I have to say, learning about you, you're so adventurous and very generous. And we're going to talk a lot about community music making today. And also such an expressive player. I've listened so much to your recordings and just, yeah, fantastic musician.
Thank you.
And your story of getting to know Macedonian music so deeply, we'll get into in a moment. But when you first got really interested in listening to the Gaida, I understand you were on this rafting trip in Australia with a bunch of friends. No, I was just surprised because, I mean, in Canada, people don't go on rafting trips that I know for like living on rafts for 2 weeks. It seems very dangerous to me. Like, how did that work?
Well, we chose a very slow and relaxed river. You probably wouldn't be allowed to do it nowadays. So we're talking, this is sort of back in the 1970s, so a fair while ago. And so we built the rafts ourselves. It was something that started off with seven of us and it ended up with 14 of us. So we started off, I think, with three rafts and ended up with seven as the word got back to friends that what a great time we were having it. And most of us did it for about three months. The bagpipes I had discovered actually just prior to that trip. And so it was on that trip that I was like listening over and over again to this album that I discovered. And how I fell in love with the Macedonian bagpipes was as simple as listening to an album in a friend's record collection. I was staying over and I found this album. I went, okay, that looks interesting. Macedonian folk dances. And I put it on and it was like instant love. I just fell in love with the sound of that instrument, of the gaida, of the Macedonian bagpipe. And I sort of knew pretty much straight away that I would somehow get to learn that instrument. And then on that raft trip, I sort of basically that cassette copy that I made of the album was on permanent rotating every day. Then so happened then that the following year I ended up going to Europe and ended up living in London for 2.5 years making instruments, musical instruments, and found a group of musicians who are playing that music and managed to borrow some Macedonian bagpipes and eventually went to Macedonia and found a teacher.
And when you got there, I understand your van broke down and then you had this 3 month immersion living with your teacher.
Yeah, well, in fact, it was lucky that the van broke down because myself and Adam Heilbrunn, who was another musician that I was playing with in London, he played the kabal, the end-blown flute, Macedonian end-blown flute. We decided that we wanted to go to Macedonia and find teachers of those instruments. And so we bought a combi and we were traveling across from London to Skopje, our destination, and the combi broke down on the coast of Yugoslavia. And it was pretty much, we thought we'd be able to fix it, but it was pretty much irretrievably lost. And that was the best thing that happened. It could have happened really, because the plan was to live in that combi during the Macedonian winter, which would have been freezing. It was freezing. But it meant we had to look for accommodation. And in looking for that accommodation, we just happened to find somebody who had a granny flat. And not only did he have that granny flat, he was a Macedonian gaida player. And he played, and he just recently retired. He had a lot of time on his hands. And I ended up learning from him for 3.5 months. It was, you know, he basically spent 3 hours every day with me for that 3.5 months. And we became very, very close friends. He'd recently retired, but he'd retired fairly early because of an injury. And in the long term anyway, how many years, 2 years after that, I ended up bringing him to Australia and as part of a group orchestra, Grupa Pechalbari, and he ended up living over in my place for a couple of months.
Yeah. And in terms of acquiring the language, how did that work for you?
Just basically pretty poor street Macedonian, which I sort of still maintain. It's still at a very beginner's level, but it allows me to communicate and understand. But basically started off with nothing. It was just lots of smiles and laughing at I don't know what. But over that period of 2.5 months, I learnt sort of basically street language very, very quickly, because very few people were speaking English in those days. Particularly where I was staying, just outside Skopje.
Mm-hmm. And since you grew up playing clarinet, and so you didn't find the embouchure too different, like to playing the gaita?
It's totally different, because really the embouchure is, we're not looking at blowing, the reed is inside the bag, really. It's inside at the top of the chanter.
Okay.
And so it's really just, it's a blowpipe. So you're not really looking at an embouchure at all. But I really did have to unlearn a lot of the classical way of thinking that I had from my clarinet training, and it was a fantastic experience, because it's part of an oral tradition, and that's how I learned from Lazo. I had the advantage of having a cassette player, and so in that 3 hours every day that we spent, I'd record, and then the rest of the day I just practice, and it was the perfect learning situation, really.
Wow. And I was just thinking, because you also, you studied the Greek clarino, I'm not sure how they say it, as well as another trip. Mm-hmm. Was that very different style of playing?
Very, very, very different. And
beyond the musical, I mean.
Physically for sure. I mean, it's, so we're back to, you know, an embouchure that is similar, but having to use a very different way of expressing, and so the embouchure changes, because you're wanting a very open throat, you're using and that particular Greek sound is what I was sort of striving for, never really getting. It's interesting, because that was, let me think, 12 years later that I went to Greece. Mm-hmm. I'd stopped playing clarinet for a while, and then I had really fallen in love with the sound of the Greek and the Turkish styles of playing. And so I managed to find somebody to teach me in the north of Greece, in Serres, Stavros Vestekis. And so I stayed there with Jess, my partner, and she was playing darabuka, the drum. And we were just lucky, because Stavros was just an incredibly kind and generous teacher, but he also had a whole sort of group of friends that at least four nights a week would go out to different tavernas scattered around the countryside, and we'd get to go with them, and many of them were musicians. So it was four nights a week. There was just this fantastic music that we were exposed to, and my take up of the Greek language was definitely a lot slower than the Macedonian. I think I was a bit older by that stage, and also it's a more difficult language. So, but we communicated again through smiles and jokes and through music, and that was also a great experience.
Yeah. So Australia, like Canada, is a country of immigrants. And I found it really interesting part of your story that when you first got into Macedonian music, you didn't realize what a vibrant community there existed already.
Mm, that's
it
right.
It was just something over there. Can you talk about the experience when you first discovered that community back in Australia?
Well, that's quite an interesting and funny story. As you say, I was very ignorant when I went over. I'd fallen in love with the music, but I knew nothing really about the Macedonian community in Australia, which on coming back, I found was a large community, 500,000 people in what is a big continent, but with a small population. Even now we've only got around about 30 million. And I came back from Macedonia. I was totally broke. So I was out busking, and I was busking with my gaita, with the Macedonian bagpipes, in front of a cinema complex. And I did that sort of fairly regularly when I came back. And one night, a group of pretty tough looking guys sort of in the early 20s sort of came out, and they surrounded me in a circle, and I thought, what's going on? And all of a sudden their arms came up and they started dancing to the music, and I went, oh, okay, they're obviously Macedonian. And then as soon as I finished the music, they came over, you know, you're playing our music, you know, how come you're playing the Gaiders? And so we got to talking, and it turned out that a lot of them were from a dance group there, and I found out that there were about 25 different dance groups that they knew of, and that they turned out there were like literally dozens of Macedonian bands in Sydney, where I was living at the time, many dance groups. And then over a period of time, I got to be very much welcomed and accepted by the Macedonian community, and found out a lot more about the whole Macedonian experience in Australia. And that then ended up inspiring me to search a lot more in other different communities, and then led me to eventually setting up a Centre for Multicultural Music over in Perth kept going. It doesn't exist now, but it went for 30 years and was a sort of a very important part of the growth of multicultural music in Australia.
I wanted to say congratulations for setting that up. And I was so sad when I read the funding got cut, and it's just such a tragedy.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the problem with funding. It's sort of certain things go in and out of fashion. There are other organisations that are doing similar things, but when I set it up back in 1983, at the end of 83, it was very much because I just believed that there was this amazing diversity of incredible music that most Australians were totally ignorant of and were not exposed to. And so I really wanted to set up a centre which nurtured that music, which acknowledged those musicians, which paid those musicians properly rather than always asking them to come and play for free at, you know, community events and so on, which was the normal case. And so the centre, which in that first of all was called the North Perth Ethnic Music Centre, then became known as the Multicultural Arts Centre, WA, and then eventually became called Culture, KULCHA. And that lasted for 30 years. But there were groups like BMAC, the Brisbane Ethnic Music and Arts Centre in Brisbane, across the other side of Australia, well, sort of where I am now, a little bit south of here. That organisation set up directly in response to that first centre. And then there was also an organisation which is still going now in Melbourne, which set up about the same time, called the Boite. It was, yeah, part of that sort of very early acknowledgement of the amazing cultural diversity that we have in Australia.
Mm-hmm. There's so many tangents, but if we can just go back a little bit to that first trip to Europe, I found your whole London story quite interesting. So you were making Renaissance flutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you set up a business to do so.
Yes.
Because you bought a lathe and you were backpacking and you couldn't carry it.
That's right. So to go even a little bit further back, when I left school, my plan was to study science, and I took a year off. And during that year, I discovered a grove of bamboo and made my first bamboo flute. And again, that was another sort of instant love affair. Just the whole process of making one's own instrument was for me very, very exciting. So I did start my science degree, and I did the first year of the science degree. But by the time I'd sort of gone into the second year of the science degree, I was already starting to earn a bit of a living by selling bamboo flutes. And I used to do that at the university outside the library. I'd sort of sit down, unroll my swag and put out the flutes on the ground, and gradually I dropped back to part-time and eventually then postponed my degree and started making wooden flutes as well, because I thought, I want to take this a step further. I became interested in early music. I was making specifically Renaissance flutes, three different sizes, the soprano, alto and tenor. And then I was lucky enough to get a small grant to visit museums with important collections of early wind instruments throughout Europe. And I traveled around Europe for 3 months, just visiting these wonderful collections of instruments and making detailed measurements of those instruments with the idea of one day making copies of them. And the final museum that I went on that tour was the Horniman Museum in London. So I ended up in London and walking through the Clerkenwell area where a lot of watchmakers. I was just looking into a watchmaker's shop, and there was this beautiful old treadle wood lathe, wood turning lathe, cast iron. So like a treadle sewing machine, it's powered by just, you know, the foot pedal. And it was for sale for £20. And I went, oh, that's ridiculous. It's so beautiful. And I did an impulse buy, knowing that I had no way of taking it anywhere. I was backpacking and I was traveling with my girlfriend at the time. I said, do you want to stay in London for a while? She was making reeds. And so we both set up a workshop. She was making double reeds for early winds, and I was making woodwind instruments. But first of all, specifically Renaissance flutes, and supplying players and also the early music shop. And that's how I sort of got to end up staying in London for a couple of years. And inadvertently, well, not so inadvertently, I guess it was also a desire to find other people, but finding other musicians who are interested in Macedonian music by finding a Macedonian or Yugoslav dance group who danced the dances of Yugoslavia, Serbia, Croatia, but particularly were interested in Macedonian music and dance. And just luckily there was this group of musicians already playing music with that dance group, and then I became part of that really vibrant sort of Macedonian music scene with those other musicians.
Yeah. So Lindsay, I have a couple questions about that, but I was just curious, did you ever perform in the Renaissance world as a woodwind player or a flutist or not? You weren't in that music?
I definitely was playing it. During that time in Europe, when I was traveling from museum through the various museums, I also went to a summer school in Austria. And there was an instrument maker, John Hanchett, who is a very well-known early wind maker based in England. And he was running that course. And I actually made myself an alto curtal. So that's like a predecessor of the bassoon. But that stage, they would have four sizes, the bass curtal or dulcian, which eventually became the bassoon, the tenor, the alto, and the soprano curtal. And so they're double reed instruments with a parallel bore that doubles up on itself like the bassoon. And I played in an early music wind ensemble associated with the Early Music Centre in London. We weren't performing. It was just something that, you know, I love doing. And so I sort of got into playing the curtal with that group. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. And you mentioned briefly before about busking. So I know you busked a lot across Europe. Did you ever have any, like you had mentioned that story, you were worried about aggression when it was actually friendly Macedonians, but did you have any experiences where people tried to steal from you or it was bad?
No. With that trip, I wasn't busking so much in Europe. Later on different trips, I busked a lot throughout Europe. And always it was very friendly, except one time in Zurich when the police took me into custody for a little while for playing a prohibited instrument. And I was playing the bagpipe, and the bagpipe was prohibited. And another time in Zurich when a pot of water was poured from the second sort of story balcony over my head. Yeah. And some local passers-by said, oh, you were lucky. It was more than water that was poured on the last busker.
Oh.
So
that's unfortunate.
But in London, I did quite a lot of busking, just usually with one of my little soprano folk flutes, and okay. sort of added to my income from the instrument making.
Yeah. So back to Macedonia and the and dance groups. I'm curious. So did you learn some of the dances, and did that help you with the rhythms, the polyrhythms?
Yeah, absolutely. It really the dance and the music are sort of they're intrinsically linked. You know, there's not one with the other. I mean, the gaita is very much an instrument for dancing. It's used also for singing, you know, for accompanying songs, but the traditional dance very often is accompanied by a gaita and a tapan, that's a large Macedonian drum. And so when I was mm-hmm. with Lazo, he also taught me a lot of the dances to the tunes, and I notated all of those. And I had originally got into the music also partly from learning the dancing. I had found a group, this is before I went to Europe in Sydney. There was a wonderful dance teacher, Gary Dawson, who's remained a close friend ever since then. And he taught regular weekly dances as part of the Sedenka folk dance group. And it was through that group that I also started becoming aware of this amazing music from Eastern Europe, whether it was Macedonian or Bulgarian or Romanian or from Greece. And that was my sort of first real exposure to that music. And so at the Živko Fiefob dance group in London that I was part of the band playing for, we'd also, all of us would be dancing as well when we weren't playing.
Mm-hmm. And you also got interested in the Romani brass band tradition, which mm-hmm. is different.
That's right. So to take the story a little bit further, after returning from Macedonia, going back to London for a little while, the dance group, the Živko Fiefob dance group, were invited to go to Macedonia and perform at the a festival, large festival, Ilindenski Denovi Festival in Bitola, one of the main towns in Macedonia. And the whole group, dance group, and the musicians all went. So this was 6 months after I returned from Macedonia, went back to Macedonia, but this time with a group of about, must have been about 20 of us. And we performed at that festival, and through that festival met so many wonderful and amazing traditional musicians from villages and towns all over Macedonia, and received countless invitations to come and visit if we were staying on. Well, a few of us did stay on, particularly myself and a friend, Chris Gunston, who was one of the tambura players in the Živko Fiefob group. And so we stayed on for a month or so, and followed up those invitations. And one of those invitations was from a wonderful musician, Romani musician, Destin Destinovsky from the town of Berevo. And so we went and stayed with the very hospitable Destinovsky family. And it was that was my introduction to that incredible Romani brass band music, wild, improvisatory, mm-hmm. Just again, it was, I just totally fell in love with that. And later on, when I returned to Australia, but maybe a decade later, I started notating and writing some of my own compositions in that style, and then also running workshops in that style of music, and eventually mm-hmm. Having a 24-piece street band called The Unusual Suspects in where I'm living now here in Mullaney, which went for about 7 years until a few years ago, playing in that style. And to extend that story, it was many years later that I finally returned to Macedonia after about a 37 year break. And unfortunately, by that stage, Destin, who really he and I had become like brothers, he had died only a couple of years earlier. But I became very, very close friends with his two sons, Milo and Jaffa. And Milo and I organized so that I'd come back and stayed there. And I thought, no, I really, this music is so fantastic, because when I returned in 2013, the music was more vibrant and alive than when I'd been there in 78 and also 81. So we're talking about a big gap, but the music was stronger than ever. And I thought, now I've got to somehow get these musicians over to Australia. And so with the help of a wonderful folk music festival here in Queensland, the Woodford Folk Festival, we brought 19 of those musicians across for a couple of weeks to Australia to play at that festival, also in our town here in Mullaney, and also down in Brisbane. And that was an extraordinary experience. So that music also had a big impact on me.
There's so much cross-pollination in music in general. And I'm curious, because some klezmer music I've heard has that, you know, that brass band, that Romani sound. Have you played with any klezmer musicians in Australia or elsewhere?
No, not really. I've come across klezmer musicians, and there are some great musicians down in Melbourne in particular playing that music. But yeah, there's a lot of, as you say, there's a lot of cross-pollination, and you can see the roots of that music and where it's come from. And for me, that's the beauty of that music, and how it spreads and how it's shared. And for example, one of the musicians who played clarinet in The Unusual Suspects was also very interested and had played in various klezmer bands. So there's definitely that cross-pollination happening over here as well.
I saw a wonderful YouTube video with The Unusual Suspects that you guys had filmed, and one of your friends was sort of dancing like a sort of a clown figure and just engaging with the people.
It was
really wonderful. And you've done so much like performance art and theater and humor as part of your shows, really meshed together.
For me, that's an important part of it. A lot of my we have sort of solo shows, which really were a major part of my life and work, I guess, since early 90s. And those solo shows have taken me all over the world and probably been my main bread and butter for a long while. But for me, that sort of sense of fun and humour is really important, because it opens the possibility to, I guess, to a range of people who might not have been necessarily attracted to that style of music if it was being just played on a concert stage. But when it's brought in with that sort of element of fun and humour, they're sort of more open to it. And then finally they realise that they actually do like this music, even though it's very different from anything they've heard before. So I do certainly love adding that element of sort of fun and humour. I mean, even if it's sort of something as simple as making an instrument from a watering can or using a rubber glove to show people the different possibilities that there are in terms of music making.
Yeah, I was reminded, I'd seen many of your videos have gone viral over the years, especially your clarinet. But I was actually looking for a duduk player for this series, and then I saw one of your duduk videos, and I was like, oh, of course, I should talk to him if he'd possibly agree to speak with me. It was just so wonderful. And then I saw your video teaching people how to make a duduk reed from just a pipe, a plastic pipe. It was just it's so inspiring. Would you be up for playing some duduk music for us?
Sure. So what's the best way to describe this? I've the duduk is another instrument that I've sort of totally fallen in love with, and I do have a number of Armenian duduks, but have never become a player of the Armenian duduk as such. But I became very interested in the idea of, as an instrument maker, because by the 1990s and the early 2000s, and also for the last 20 years, I've been making instruments a lot from found objects. And so I wanted to come up with an instrument that was very much like the duduk, but maybe using a reed that was a little bit easier to make and longer lasting. And so here we've got, it's basically a bit of plastic irrigation pipe or poly pipe, polyethylene. So here in Australia, we can buy 20 meters of this for $8. And this is pretty much the shape, you know, very similar shape to the Armenian duduk reed, which is made from cane. And that's what it sounds like by itself. But when I put it onto this tube, and so this is a particular instrument that I have designed, which is based on the Armenian duduk. And but I've designed it so that I can use cross-fingering like on a recorder to get a fully chromatic scale. So it's only got the range of a ninth, but using cross-fingering, I can get a chromatic scale. So this is a hybrid duduk. And the reed itself, I must give credit to Javi Lozano. He's a wonderful Spanish instrument maker. And in a way, we've got a very similar approach. He makes lots of wind instruments out of found objects. He loves the use of humor in his work, as well as being a maker. He also performs and makes his own videos. And I'd been mucking around with this idea with making these duduk reeds out of polypipe, but fairly unsuccessfully. And then one day I came across a video of his, a TED talk, where in 3 minutes he made a reed very similar to that. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to try again, because he just did it in 3 minutes. And so his approach was a little bit different. He used a hammer to flatten this out, whereas I'd been sort of squeezing it and sanding it and so on. And so I tried his technique, and straight away there was more success. And then I sort of thought, I think there's actually ways also of improving this, and let's try and make it sound more like the Armenian duduk. So I'll give you a listen to what it sounds like. I might just give myself a drone just to work with, and also I'll just turn around and turn that on.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
So beautiful, Lindsay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about improvisation because you're such a beautiful improviser, and all the styles of music with improvisation have attracted you for so long. But when you were growing up doing, I presume, classical clarinet, when you were a young man, were you doing any, like, just making stuff up or writing music?
So I started learning clarinet when I was about 11 and went through about, 9 years of classical training. But like a lot of kids all through high school, I sort of had a few different bands, and more those bands got involved in improvising. At first, I guess, in a sort of a jazz style. One of the people that I played with was quite a good jazz pianist. And we had our first band, which was in the first year of high school, was called the Hooten Twangers. And then we had a group called the Rajas, RAJAZZ. And then we're basically sort of playing contemporary pop, a mixture of sort of Rolling Stones and Beatles sort of stuff, but also giving it, a bit of a jazz twist. But by the time I got to the final years of high school, I had discovered serious contemporary classical music. And my first, really huge excursion in improvisation was deciding, and this was when, I think it was in my final year of high school, deciding to put on a performance of The Tiger's Mind by Cornelius Cardew. So that is at that stage was a very contemporary work, but it was, the score was a story, and it was about the tiger, Amy, the mind, I'm trying to think of all of the different characters, but each performer represented one of those characters, and the score was basically the story of how the mind, the tiger, and Amy, the girl, intertwined. And we ended up doing two performances of that. And so that was sort of the first excursion publicly that I did into sort of very free improvisation. But I always have been interested in improvisation and have just explored this sort of different ways and different styles of doing that, I guess.
I wanted to ask you about your live looping, because you were a real pioneer when you started this in the early 90s, and the technology was very primitive, right?
Very primitive. I first started looping when I moved from Sydney, where I was living, and Jess, my partner, who we've been together for 36 years, one of her sons had been living with her down in Adelaide, but then moved back up to Queensland, and another son was living up in Queensland. So we moved back to Queensland, where Jess had originally been living, and we lived in, or moved to, a very small town of 300 people called Kinkin. And we actually were living there for 19 years until about 10 years ago. But of course, it meant that I left all my musical colleagues behind me in Sydney, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I came across a woman who had a performance name of Violinda, and she did a solo looping show, and that was the first live looping that I'd seen. And this is back in 1990, and so I sort of thought, maybe that's what let's try that. And at that stage, the technology was very quite primitive, and my first looping device was a delay pedal that had a hold function, and that hold function gave me a 1.8 second long loop. And so my first solo show was totally built around a 1.8 second loop. I've got no idea what that sounded like now, many years later. But then over the next 30 years, I've sort of developed a whole range of different solo looping shows, which, as we were talking before, involved sort of an element of fun, and particularly was based around the whole concept of instruments made from found objects. So that very first show was called Bang It With a Fork, and I was a kid at the sink doing the washing up, and everything was made from the sink, and all of the pots and pans and everything in the sink, as well as a few wind instruments that were made from found objects. The next show after that was called Knocking on Kevin's Door, and where I was a roadie setting up for a gig, totally ignoring the audience for 1 hour. But as I set up in the guise of Kevin, the roadie, he created music from all of the stuff that he was setting up, whether it was the music stands, the microphone stands, the gaffer tape, the music folders, or whatever. The next show after that was called The Art of Food, and I was a crazy chef called Ivan, and all the music was made from food or kitchen utensils. And that was where the first sort of carrot clarinet sort of raised its head, and I've ended up using that for many years. So, that was sort of basically the looping that sort of developed over that period of time, and also as the technology evolved, I would move from one different looping setup to another, and right now I've sort of am still doing some looping, but not with the current solo show that I was working on earlier this year. Is a little bit different, because that's called Searching for That Sound, which is a little bit like this podcast in a way. It's like me sort of telling about my journey and playing music along the way, and it's from stepping from instrument to instrument, but also using some looping.
Wow, sounds great. I was thinking how I loved your thing you did with the bicycle. So brilliant.
Yeah.
Was that part of one of those shows, or was that a totally separate?
Yeah, that was one of those shows. So that was the show. Yeah, the show was called Psychology, as in cycle, C-Y-C-L-O-G-Y. And in that performance, my character was Professor Squealy Deepbum, who was basically lecturing on the possibilities of the bicycle as a performance tool or instrument. But he had also had a sidekick called Dietrich, and Dietrich sort of opened the show, and then Professor Squealy Deepbum took over. Actually, I brought that over to Canada at one stage.
I'm sorry, I missed it. Where were you touring in Canada?
Mainly up in the Northeast. Yeah, so right up to Prince Edward Island. Mainly in the Quebec province. The agent who was running it at that stage was based in Montreal.
Okay, and you don't normally do you speak in these shows, or is it just all miming and music?
The early shows were very much more about the music and the mime, with just occasional key expressions, which became a very important part of each show. And some of the character, Ivan the chef, grunted a lot and exclaimed, and certain exclamatory remarks. The Squealy Deepbum, the professor, spoke in a very, very high-pitched voice, which was gobbledygook. After around about the first five shows, then there was a lot more talking, and it became less character-based and more about demystifying the whole process of making music and making instruments. And so I used language and talking quite specifically about the instruments and to inspire people to have a go themselves, basically.
In terms of looping, during the pandemic, I get the impression a lot of people were isolated and started to experiment with looping who hadn't, you know, who were looping curious.
Yeah.
Did you get people asking you advice about that?
Actually, no, not really. I mean, over the years, of course, I've run quite a lot of looping workshops, and I have noticed that, you know, through the pandemic that did happen, but I haven't had so many. I think now, because there's so much online, people can sort of explore it quite easily online. Yeah, and there's it's sort of pretty transparent in so many ways now because of the amount of information there is now available.
Did you bring any instruments today that are with found objects?
We could explore the bagpipe theme. So
whatever you'd like.
Well, let's do that, seeing we started with the Macedonian bagpipe. Mm-hmm. So obviously I've got this peculiar attraction to bagpipes, or not so peculiar. But I discovered quite early on, in my very, very early shows, and particularly shows that I took onto the streets of Europe, created different bagpipes using rubber gloves, because the beauty of a rubber glove is it holds air, and because it's rubber and flexible, as it expands, it provides its own pressure. And so it's this wonderful bag that you don't actually have to be pressing with your arm. And so I've created a number of different types of bagpipes with the rubber glove. So it's very simple, basically, just like the Macedonian bagpipe or other bagpipes, you blow in, that's your bag. It's sort of self-pressured because of the rubber. This is the most recent version I've made of rubber glove bagpipe. So it's got a drone here. The interesting thing about these, the chanter and the drone, is that, well, I won't pull it off because it's going to put it out a little bit out of tune, but the reeds that I'm using are membrane reeds. So it's basically some plastic garbage bag which has been stretched over the top of the tube. The air goes into the bag and then comes back out through these tubes here, one into the drone and one into the chanter. And it's the vibration of that plastic garbage bag membrane on the top which is creating this sound.
For those listeners who are listening to the podcast, you should definitely go to the video afterwards just for the humor value of seeing that giant glove being blown up. Did you get that idea from somebody else, or did you just come up with it?
Well, I came up with that idea. I mean, since then I've seen other people who have been using that idea. I first, mm-hmm. I think, used the rubber that was in the early 90s. It was a time of great ferment, I think, for me. That was, mm-hmm. I'd moved to Queensland. I'd left behind, as I said, a lot of musician friends. And so I was sort of exploring and discovering. I was getting into instrument making, and I was mainly earning my living as an instrument maker. But then I started developing the solo shows. And so the rubber glove bagpipe was sort of right from that very first show with the kid at the kitchen sink, called Bang It With a Fork, that actually had, because that was all about washing up, because the kid was washing up, and so he had the rubber gloves, and the gloves actually were built into the sink, and they came up out of holes and blew up. Yeah.
Wonderful. I was thinking how I really enjoyed those recordings you've made. I think you live near a beautiful forest, and you go early in the morning and you record. And we hear the ambient sounds. It's not like many people are superimposing field recordings. This is live.
Yeah, that's correct. And the amazing thing is that I recorded a whole album that way, and I just discovered that the microphone in my iPad Pro was actually incredibly good way of recording in that context. And that's all I'm using. I'm actually just using the iPad with the onboard microphone and nothing overdubbed. So it's just picking up the bird sounds with whatever wind instrument I chose to play on that particular day. The only thing that was pre-recorded was that I just had a drone that I was listening to and then was part of the recording. But basically the instrument that I'm playing and the birds is just all being just recorded from that little iPad mic. Mm. And yeah, there's a whole album of those tracks. And it's something that I'm planning to do a lot more of in the coming year, just doing sunrise concerts, just inviting people to come along and just picking beautiful locations with great bird calls.
I did listen to the album, and also your album with the frog sound that somebody else had recorded, an entire album.
Yeah, that's right. That's done a little bit differently. So the frog sounds are recorded by a fantastic naturalist and frog and bird expert who's recorded a lot of Australian frogs, David Stewart. And I've used those sounds with his permission to then in it as with a sampler, and then created music using that sampler.
You have such a great sense of groove, you know, your music, a lot of it so rhythmic, and you've worked in a duo for many years with your percussionist friend. Let me remember his name, Tunji Bayer.
That's right. Yeah. Tunji. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We worked together as the duo Dva, which is the Macedonian word for two. And so for about 20 years, we played as duo. We're now actually playing with another friend, Philip Griffin, a fantastic string player, and so the three of us are now playing as a trio. That's a fairly new current project. It's simply called the Bayer Griffin Pollock Trio, and that's along with Tunji, wonderful percussionist who, when he was 16, took himself to South India, to Bangalore, and studied for 3 years South Indian percussion there. And Philip Griffin, who's a wonderful string player, playing a huge range of different string instruments, but in particular the instruments like the oud and the lauto, as well as electric bass and guitar and the Afghani rebab.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And have you learned any of that hand percussion, like from Tunji, has he taught you any of that? I was just curious since...
I've always been interested in and played a bit of percussion, but never when you have a percussionist as amazing as Tunji, I'm very happy just to sit on the winds and play along. And so, yeah, I haven't actually specifically had lessons or learnt from him, but just collaborated a lot on the music that we create together.
I wanted to talk about your Hugh Marimba project.
So again, with my fascination for making instruments and making them simple, I've always loved the marimba and the xylophone, particularly the marimba, and had the idea that it would be a wonderful community instrument. But one of the difficult things when traveling around and running workshops is with a marimba, it's a big instrument. And a lot of that bulk and weight is to do with the stand that's holding up the keys. And one morning I woke up and I went, but what if the people playing were the stand? And so I got the idea of hooking a marimba onto belts of two players, one at each end, and developed a whole style of marimba music, of which I've written a lot for the various workshops and groups that I've run, where the music is three part marimba music, played by three people, one on each end and one in the middle. And first of all, I really was more involved in making workshops so people could make their own marimbas, and then more and more got into writing and composing music which people who'd never played before could handle and gradually build that. And then when I moved to Kinkin, as I mentioned before, moved up to Queensland, I guess after about being there for nearly 10 years, it was about 10 years, I was approached by one of the mums from the local school saying, would you teach our kids to play marimba? Because they knew that I'd sort of travelled all over Australia running these workshops. And they also knew of the band that my partner Jess and I and our two closest friends, Mick and Ali, we had a band called Xylosax, which was based all around the Hugh Marimba, plus other instruments that I brought into the group. And they said, would you teach our kids? And I said, well, you know what? I think I'm going to say no. What I'm going to say is that I'll teach the parents. I said, it's a very unnatural thing for kids to learn something before the parents. So why don't we do it in a more traditional manner where it's something that can be then, you know, sort of passed on? I said, I'm very happy to teach the parents, and then let's wait until the kids themselves want to play. I don't want you to want them to play. I want the kids to really have a hunger to do it themselves. So I started running classes, and a group called K Karimba started, which ran for 7 years. Eventually was when I left Kinkin, it was taken over by one of the people that I'd been teaching. And we had and always would have pretty much 24 people in that group. So it was over the 7 years, it would eventually developed so that we were out sometimes out performing. But every Tuesday night in this small town of 300, we had 24 people playing, and sometimes people left the group, but there were always people who came in. So I worked out that over the period of those 7 years, we had 40 people from Kinkin playing. Well, that's over 10%. So I think that pretty much that was the marimba hotspot on the planet. When you look at the number of people playing marimba in that town, certainly 10% of the town were playing marimba. And that was a very a mainstay of my community music making for quite a while. I've done, one of my big passions is teaching people to make their own instruments and make their own music. And the Hugh Marimba was perfect for that, because it was an instrument that anyone can make, And there was one point where a music festival, it's now called the Queensland Music Festival, at that stage it was called the Brisbane Biennial, back in 1995, they commissioned me to do a project to, within the community, make a whole lot of marimbas, enough so that we could put them right across the Brisbane River, which is a wide river. So we made 160 marimbas that went end to end, attached to the railings of this bridge that went across the river. And for 9 days of the festival, those marimbas were up for people to play. And then they went back to the families or the people who'd made them. So we had, over the 10 weeks that the workshop was open, we made, I think there was 2,400 marimba bars were made and tuned. And I've forgotten how many people exactly, but I think we had a huge number of people involved in making them, from 11 years old to 91 years of age.
Wow. It's such a beautiful story. I saw a video of that project. Mm. The tuning, I mean, that must take such finesse. I mean, if you cut it off too short, it's too high, you have to start again.
There's a few things involved. So the length, as you said, the length is important, but that's quite easy because I'd worked out all the measurements for these instruments. Using a particular, it's different depending on the instrument, but actually the most of the tuning is done by how much you cut away underneath. So the more you cut away, the lower the note. So there was one, for example, I designed a children's show where all the whole set was musical instruments made from different things. So the garden fence in there were four houses side by side, and the garden fence on one of the houses was a total marimba, but all the lengths were all the same. And so I managed to get two octaves just by the amount that was cut out from underneath from just that same length. So it is possible to actually tune it that way. But yeah, so it's more the fact that when you're actually cutting away underneath, or you're just using a tool called a surform, which is sort of just like a big handheld rasp, you get to a point where you've just got to start slowing down on the amount that you're taking away. So as you get to within a semitone of the sound that you want, of the note that you want, then you know to slow down. Yeah, there were three of us that were running the workshops there. So the workshops were open for that 10-week period. And yeah, basically the main job you had in that workshop was keeping an eye who's getting close, who's within a semitone of the note that they're going for, and they're getting them to sort of to slow down on their work. But yeah, it's a really great way to gain an understanding about pitch and the relationship of pitch to length, and in terms of bar percussion instruments or tuned percussion, great to get an understanding about that cutaway and how that slows down the rate of vibration as you cut more from the center.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful thing. What happened to that fence?
I don't know. We just, it's interesting. That show was back again in the early 90s. And we just about 2 months ago had a reunion of all the people that were in that show. And so there was the instruments, yeah, ended up being scattered around many of us. And, but I still, from the big marimba project, the one that went across the Brisbane River, I still have a number of those marimbas still with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, the installation, it should be in some kind of public place or museum where, I mean, the work that went into building that garden fence, that's a musical instrument. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So you've done so much theater, like you had studied some theater, right? Early in your career.
I've never studied theatre. It's just sort of, you know, something I guess I've picked up along the road, sort of creating shows and working with other people, and being lucky enough to have that, the opportunity to work with some fantastic people. And so I've sort of learned over many years, just really, I mean, for example, that performance Out of the Frying Pan with was a cast of five of us, but just working with a fantastic lighting designer, fantastic theatre set designer, fantastic director. Those sort of things you learn, you know, you learn from those people that you're working with. So that first show, that was one of the first really big shows that that was in the Brisbane Concert Hall. So it was a show for 3 to 8 year olds. And I'd never done a performance quite like that, but that ended up touring all over Australia, that particular performance. And then since then, I've sort of created great works, but sort of learning as I go a lot, and learning from other people and collaborating. Mm. And so it's just one of those things that it's a lovely way to learn.
Yeah. And you had this group, the Paranormal Music Society, where you would improvise with audience participation for the titles and the themes.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So the Paranormal Music Society were along with Romano Crivici, a very, very old and dear friend, and another great friend, Blair Greenberg. And we, as you said, pretty much the whole performance was improvised based on title suggestions from the audience. So they could make up whatever title they liked, and we'd create a piece of music based around that. But it also created music from throwing a giant dice. Somebody from the audience would throw the dice, and on the six sides of the dice there were musical notes. And so might throw it once, A, throw it again, G, throw it again, another G, throw it again, okay. C, and throw it again, fifth time, E. And that five-note musical theme then would be the basis of that piece. And so that was, totally improvised piece. And a lot of my projects have been very firmly based in improvisation. Another of those projects was a project called QWERTY.
I was going to ask you about that.
And I think for me, that's one of the most incredible improvised projects that I've been involved with. So again, it was a trio, three of us. Peter Rowe has autism and Down syndrome, as a result of that can't speak. However, he's got an incredibly brilliant mind, and luckily he can communicate through a process called facilitated communication. Unfortunately, no one found out until he was 30 that that there was this amazing active incredible intellect until he was able to be shown this means of communication. And basically facilitated communication it's like a QWERTY keyboard, but just on a cardboard board or a wooden board. And Peter, or whoever's communicating, points to the letters on the board and spells out the words. And with practice, that can be incredibly fast. And I met Peter as part of another project, and we created a theatre performance using that facility, where two of the performers would write songs on stage live, and then their facilitators would sing the words. So we created a trio where his facilitator was also a great singer, and Peter would write the words. We'd have no idea what the song was going to be about. Sometimes I'd start the music. So I was using, again, live looping, but I was using also a MIDI wind controller. So I had a huge range of sounds through the MIDI wind instrument, and then live looping those, and then working with Peter's words and with Delaney, who was singing those words. If you can imagine being a singer, singing the words that you've just read, as you're singing them, you're having to watch the next line that's being created at the same time as singing the previous line. So it's an amazing sort of feat, really, and just the whole process, even to, well, I was saying even to me from being inside the group, I think, but probably especially for me being inside the group, it was always exhilarating and incredible, just sort of being part of that process of walking on stage and not having an absolute clue where it was going to go over the next hour.
So beautiful. My mom worked at a children's hospital, and I remember she, so it was in the 80s, talking about that technology, which I think was relatively new at that time, and how it was opening up these children's worlds.
Yeah. And it's wonderful.
You mentioned the MIDI wind controller. You have something you've developed, like Lyrebird, I think you call it. It's because to imitate different sounds that you've used in some of your new work.
The MIDI wind controller is that I use is a quite an older version. It's a Yamaha WX5. Mm-hmm. Lyrebird is just my name for that instrument.
Yeah.
So I haven't developed it. It's just that it's an off the shelf wind controller made by Yamaha called WX5. Okay. But I'm using it differently in that the project that I've been doing with a wonderful singer, Lizzie O'Keefe, we've been working together for 8 years on a project called Dangerous Song. And I'm using the MIDI wind controller to play the sounds of endangered species. So they're in the same way that I use frog sounds on that album that you mentioned before. Mm. Here I'm using the sounds of a whole range of endangered species. And it's basically a project that is using our art form to express our response to the current sixth extinction crisis. And so we've done a number of different multimedia shows and many concerts using mm-hmm. those sounds. And again, using live looping, because the wind controller using breath, and I can control the length of the note, which follows obviously the cry or the sound of the animal, I can use that incredibly emotive sound of, you know, like some of the gibbons, for example, and lemurs and various animals that use the melodic nature of their call to create the melody as well as the six octaves that I can play using that MIDI wind controller, but using those sounds.
So you must have studied the sounds of these animals quite a bit to be able to do that.
Rather than studying them, I've collected them over many years, and there are many of those sounds are available online now, and many more now than there were, say, when in 15 years ago when I started doing it. So there's an extraordinary range of just fantastic sounds, and of course, as I'm collecting them, we always are studying like those species whose sounds that they were using to get a sense of why they're becoming extinct, where they are, where the ones that we've lost and so on.
But you must have a really amazing oral memory to be able to, it just strikes me in general that you must have a great musical memory.
In which sense do you mean, in terms
even these animal calls, Lindsay, that you could remember them so well and be able to reproduce them. Most people couldn't do that.
I guess I'm not having to reproduce them because the calls are right there. So it's just a matter of me dialing them up on the iPad. How it works is that I collect the sounds. So there's a whole range of sounds, and then I might tweak a sample so that I know from a 27-second recording, I've got, okay, this 3 seconds is going to be musically really useful. Mm-hmm. Let's say that Indri Indri, which is a giant lemur from Madagascar, which is critically endangered, it's got this extraordinary sort of voice that's sort of very, very melodic and long calls. Now, I could use, say 10 seconds of that call or 5 seconds, but that in a way is too long to be able to work in the way that we're working with the music mm-hmm. we're creating. So I might use just 3 seconds of that call and then that's stored in the iPad in a particular program that I'm using called ThumbJam, which is also a live looping program. So it was sort of made for me, really, even though it wasn't. So those sounds are stored in the iPad. The MIDI wind controller, which is just basically like a clarinet, but it's controlling those sounds. So it's like a synthesizer, but with breath control. When I play a particular note, it's going to play that pitch of that sound. So if I play an A, I've set it up so that I know I'm going to get an A, that the Indri is going to the attack of its call is going to be an A. It might move off the A over the next few seconds. So if I just blow a short note, I'll just get that the very, how long I blow determines how much of the call is used. Then I can play melodically, so I can play a melody using that animal's voice. But I can also, by changing the length of my breath on each of those notes, it gives me different degrees or lengths of that animal's call. It's a little bit hard to sort of, I should have actually have it set up here so I could sort of, show you how it works.
Yeah. Very well, and people can listen to your recordings. No, I misunderstood that somehow you were imitating live.
Yeah, no, it's the actual sound. I've got all of those are stored in a program, and I can and I can access them and change very, very quickly and live loop them very, very quickly.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I still think you must have a great musical memory because you've learned so many different styles over the years and so many traditional tunes and modes. And
yeah, well, that's true, because if I'm using that Indri sound, I've got to know exactly how it sounds, so that it's not just this random sound that comes out. I need to know how I can use that call at each pitch, because I might be dropping that pitch by, say, two octaves, because I want to use it as a bass sound. So in that sense, I might be using just like half second lengths of that first of that bass sound, but I'll be playing melodically. So I might loop a bass line with it, but then later on, I might be actually using the longer aspect of the call to create or partly create the memory, partly create the melody.
Wow. Yeah. It's a very beautiful, project that's very, very poignant. And when your name for it, the lyrebird, lyrebirds are those birds that they can imitate chainsaws and cell phone rings and all that, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
In Australia or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you heard them before?
I've never heard them. I've never been lucky enough to hear one live. They're not sort of common, but they're not, I know many people who have heard them. Yeah. Where do you want to go from?
Well, what do you have there?
Well, I might just do that sort of description of how it works and build a piece, so I can that way we can look at some live looping as well.
Wonderful.
So with Dangerous Song, this is the instrument, which I call Lyrebird. It's a Yamaha WX5 wind controller. So I've got the different sounds stored in the iPad, and the WX5 or Lyrebird is connected, so I can control the sound. So if I play the full call, so that's the full call, or an octave up, octave down. I can use it at bass, two octaves down. So I can do something like this, for example. Add another loop layer. Mm-hmm. So that gives you just a very simple idea how the loop's built up. So if I select now a different instrument, if I go to, say, Blakiston's Fish Owl. So once again, I can play it very short, or the full call.
Beautiful. So was that first call that you used at the end, was that a whale or?
No, that after Blakiston's Fish Owl, I changed to this one, which is a black cockatoo. So it's a Carnaby's black cockatoo, which comes from over in West Australia. So it's endangered because of habitat loss. So it originally or still is living in an area which is a wheat growing area. And so as the wheat growing has taken out and wiped out the natural bushland, that's reduced the amount of natural habitat of that particular cockatoo. So the beautiful birds, we've got a number of different types of black cockatoos around Australia, and that's one of the endangered ones. So, yeah, so that, I mean, I had no idea what I was going to create then. I just sort of put something just very simple down with this, those two bird sounds. But that sort of gives you an idea of the live looping combined with those animal sounds. And so the original pitch of that bird call. So that repetition is actually the bird itself. So I'm doing a very long breath. So that was that sort of five or six calls was all one call from that animal. But then I can take it down. So I can use it in that, just using those short breaths as a melodic way, but then I can use it in a more emotive way using the full call. Earlier on I mentioned the Indri Indri, the Madagascan lemur. So that's the original pitch. And then I can use it. hopefully that gives an idea.
Yeah. Did you have that idea percolating for a long time before you started to use it?
I guess it developed, it probably was percolating in a way and just trying different, you know. So, for example, the frog music was created from the samples, not using this instrument, but using a sampler, and it was used percussively. So using a, where I'm using just triggering samples on the sampler. Then when I first started experimenting with this, I had a bit of a love-hate relationship with it because I just longed for a more acoustic and more organic sound. And then I sort of thought, well, what if I experiment with animal sounds? That's going to give me a more, you know, just because of the flexibility and the way that the calls move, it's going to be straight away, it's going to be more emotive and more organic in the sort of sounds, even though it's, you know, it's digital because it's stored as a sample. Mm-hmm. And so I started with that idea, and then I sort of thought, just because of my ecological concerns, just looking at a musician's and artist's response to the current extinction crisis, I came up with the idea of a show called The Extinction Room. So it was originally a solo show, and all the audience wore headphones and I was in the center of the circle, but the audience were all facing outwards away from me. So I was in the middle of them, and all my gear was in the center with all of the leads going to the headphones. I originally had 20 different sets of headphones, and I took that show over. It was commissioned by a festival in Singapore, and did that over there. But everyone was blindfolded, so that they were just so they had a total good quality audio stereo audio sound of what was going on, but no external visual sensors. So and that. That was the first time that I used those, and that I did that for a couple of years. And then I still was a little bit dissatisfied with, even though they're the real sounds of the animals, it still had a very digital quality to it. And then I just had the idea of combining with a singer. And initially I did a project, a big outdoor project. It was an outdoor show called The Dream of Zed Cat Naboo, and that used four singers. But it was a big production, and I realized it would be hard to sort of keep remounting. And I thought, oh, it would be nice just to do a stage show where it was just with a number of singers, but where we weren't having to build a set every time we wanted to do the show. And then I met Lizzie coincidentally around that time and thought, do you want, you know, I asked, invited her to come and have a jam in the studio, thinking that maybe she could be one of those singers. And I'd heard her singing some jazz, and she had a great voice. And we, with the Unusual Suspects, that sort of gypsy Romany brass band sort of style, one night we were playing at a festival, it was New Year's Eve, and the Jimmy, the trumpet player in the band, said, "Oh, there's Lizzie, get her to come and sing with us." And I'm thinking, that's not really fair on her. We've got a, you know, cruddy little microphone going through a little speaker. We've got five percussionists and, you know, 17 brass players. It's not really a fair thing. But I thought, oh, why not? It's New Year's Eve. Let's do it. And anyway, she got on mic and just blew me away. And I sort of thought, oh, okay, maybe she might be one of those singers. So she came into right here, where I am at the moment, and we had a jam using these sounds and with me doing the sorts of work that I'd been doing in the Extinction Room, the solo show. And straight away it just became obvious. I said to Lizzie, I'd love to work with you on this if you're interested. And she said, yeah, I'd love to. And then at that point I thought, well, actually I think one singer's enough. And so we've been working together for the last 8 years on that.
Collaboration is so, so wonderful. And of course, so many of us were so isolated in the earlier part of the pandemic. Mm. And so much of the work you've done in community music over the years is just convincing everybody that we're all musicians You can make your own instruments. You can use your voice.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for me, that was probably the main through line of my work, and my love for music was just exactly as you've articulated then. That's exactly what I was on about. And then as well as that, you know, I love creating my own work. And so it's been a mixture of those things throughout, I guess, doing running workshops and showing people how they can make their own music. And that, you know, for me, that's the joy is, you know, I love listening to great music, but the real joy comes from playing it and playing with others. And so, and I've wanted to share that. And through the instrument making and showing people how to make their own instruments, that's another part of, the demystifying process of just that joy of making, not only making your own music, but making your own instrument that then makes that music. And so that for sure was a whole through line through a lot of the work that I've done.
The creative flow that you get into when you're improvising, is it similar to the experience when you're making, or is that very different for you?
I think it's quite different. Yeah, because the playing and the improvising, you're very much there in the moment, and it's much more condensed. And with the making, and because even making has got different aspects, so the designing of an instrument is different from the process of once you've designed an instrument and you're actually just going through the process of following a design that you've already come up with. So the designing of an instrument is something that sometimes happens over a period of many, many months or even years. And so that's quite a big point of difference, because when you're actually creating and improvising, it's right there in that moment. And you're just thinking about that moment and where you are and the people that you're working with, if you're also working with somebody.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you're still, there's a process. So you're hammering down the polypipe for your duduk reed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In terms of, or are you sort of going off into planning mode when you're doing that?
No, I think you're pretty much sort of 100% there with when you're making an instrument. You've got to, you know, you're focused on that. I guess that, you know, of course we all go off into those other levels and of thought and thinking different things, and it's to do with how much one does one particular thing. If you're making instrument after instrument, then sure, it becomes more of a process. But say for example, when you're working on the concept of the duduk reed for the first time, I think you're totally in there. So it's like what you're saying, it's a little bit similar to that improvisatory process, I guess.
Yeah. So you have toured a lot in your life, and certainly coming from Australia, going to different continents, it takes a toll. Like, do you have strategies for staying healthy mentally and physically when you're touring, being away from home a lot?
I do generally keep pretty healthy. I think I sort of look after, you know, care for what I eat and drink and exercise and so on. But that's sort of changed a lot for a different reason. In that I'm not traveling much now, not just because I sort of beat COVID to it in a way in 2018. During 2018, I decided that I would stop. Yeah, 2019, beginning of 2019, I realized that 30% of my carbon footprint was what was virtually an annual trip to Europe, performing. Yep. and I just thought, no, I can't keep doing this. Not in the current condition. Yep. That the planet's in, I couldn't live with that. And so I made a decision at the beginning of 2019 not to do any more long haul flights. I didn't limit myself within Australia. I thought, oh, well, I'll still travel within Australia but even here, yeah, over the last 3 years, that hasn't happened, obviously. So I made that quite firm decision. And although it was a difficult decision, I felt really good about that decision. I think it was the right decision for me to make. And it meant that I wasn't going to be able to seeing a lot of the friends that I'd made in Europe. And also it was like a real shot in the arm to going and just traveling to different festivals and performing and meeting other musicians. But I'm actually really glad that I made that decision rather than it having been imposed on me by COVID. I think it was, in a way, a lot easier for me because I'd already made that decision and it was a conscious choice, a positive conscious choice of mine. So nowadays I'm actually not, you know, on the road nearly so much and not touring. But I'd always find that I just loved that touring process. It was just just as much and even more than the performing, it was also just the people that I would meet and the things that I would learn on that journey.
Mm. Yeah. But with the magic of the internet now, I mean, it astonishes me every time we're able to do things like this.
Yeah, that's right.
You're tomorrow in this completely other side of the world.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, do you have any words of wisdom before we close out for younger musicians who are scared to take a chance? Like you've been so adventurous in your life.
It's funny because I don't feel like I've been adventurous really because I've just, so I guess that would be the, you know, I don't think they're words of wisdom. I think it's just, I'd say, you know, do what you believe in. You know, I think I have been lucky that I've been able to make a life and a living from what I love doing. And I often do tell kids that, you know, over the years I've performed, done a lot of kids' performances and get to talk to kids a lot after the show. And they say, oh, how do you do that? How did you get to be a musician? You know, how did you get to do, you know, because they could sort of see what fun I'm having. And I said, well, the thing is, you know, if at all possible, if you can work out a way to live a life doing what you love doing, that's probably one of the best things that you can do. I don't feel like I've taken these sort of huge risks, but one of the things that I've done, I've never worried too much about what's going to happen next. I've just followed really my passion and what I love to do. And I've said yes to opportunity when it comes, and often you don't even realize that it's an opportunity. It's that, you know, the combi breaking down on the coast of Yugoslavia, rather than sort of getting all depressed about it, go, okay, well, what's next? What do we do? And just realizing that, you don't even realize it at the time. It's years later, you go, wow, that was the best thing that could have happened. And just rolling with the punches, really. You just sort of, take everything as a new and wonderful adventure.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for sharing your music and your stories today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Leah.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.